And darling, lay my burdens down.
Okay, so I'm Lisa. I think most of you know that. So behind me, there are some words, and I'd like you to have a little read through them and just see if you can figure out what they might have in common. You can have a murmur amongst yourselves if you like. And just shout it out if you think you've got it. I would say there's no wrong answer, but there is only one right answer. There's no French connection, but, well, kind of, I guess. Basically, the way that you say these words is a little bit different to the way that they look like they should be said. In fact, I've overheard people, mainly members of my own family, mispronounce all of these words at one stage or another. One member of my extended family, not Simon, was heard to say about newborn human babies one time, but you can't tell what colour their eyes will be until they start to open. Is that at about 4 weeks, or is it older than that? So it's pretty easy to laugh when someone else makes these kinds of mistakes, but I'm sure you can all relate to that feeling when you have that moment when you realise that you're the one who's been pronouncing a word wrong. You're the one who's been making the mistake, and you've thought something was one way, and actually it's another. And that's a bit how I feel at the moment. This morning, I'm inviting you to come with me as I explain how I've discovered that I've been misreading the parable of the prodigal son my whole life. Please be patient. I'm in the middle of this epiphany, more at the stage of realizing that I've been pronouncing it wrong rather than being able to instruct you on how to pronounce it correctly. And there'll be lots of you here this morning who are actually further along than I am in this journey, but I'm hoping that there'll be something new for most. So we've got Luke chapter 15 that we're going to read. I've got a few people to help me. The first person reading the lost sheep is Brian Shepherd. Get it?
Very appropriate. Parable of the lost sheep. Now tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in an open space and looks for the lost sheep? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it upon his shoulders and goes home. He calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you, in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent.
Thanks, Brian. So, Lisa.
Okay, Luke 15:8-10. The parable of the lost coin. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I've found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents.
Thanks. And then finally, my little brother.
So this is Luke 15:11-32, parable of the lost son. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For the son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when the son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, You are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.
Thank you. I think it's fair to say that the final of these three parables, the lost son, is best known as the prodigal son. Now for my first confession. Until about 2 months ago, I didn't even know what the word prodigal meant. So as a 60th birthday present from me to Mick Duncan, I'd like you to turn to the person next to you and tell them what you think the word prodigal means. Go. Okay, you can stop. Put you out of your misery. If you'd asked me, I would have said something along the lines of, well, it means when someone goes away and does a bunch of rebellious or reckless stuff and then comes home. But that's wrong. It actually means spending freely and recklessly, being wastefully extravagant, or having or giving something on a lavish scale. Can I have it in a sentence, I hear you ask? Well, you could say, that pavlova Lois made was prodigal with whipped cream. Now, there'll be a couple of smarty pants who knew that already, but just stick with me. So we've established that I didn't even correctly understand the title of this story until recently, but don't worry, it gets worse. I've read a couple of books and I've listened to a classic sermon about this part of the Bible, and this has heavily influenced what I'll be saying next. The books by Kenneth Bailey and Timothy Keller and the sermon by a man called Edmund Clowney have helped to open my eyes to the layers and depth of this story. Timothy Keller has said, if the teaching of Jesus is likened to a lake, this famous parable would be one of the clearest spots where we can see all the way to the bottom. I'm sure Mr. Keller would be heartened to hear that I agree with him. Another confession. Often when I read the Bible, when I read the things that Jesus said and the things that he did, my main reaction is not one of adoration and amazement at his love for me. It's usually confusion and bewilderment. But as I've been learning more about the cultural context of this story, I feel like I'm seeing deeper into the lake than I have for a long time. The first part of this story that I'd never really paid much attention to was the audience. Jesus wasn't only talking to a bunch of hungry people far from home in pig pens. He wasn't addressing an AA meeting or speaking at the local city mission. Who was in the audience? Well, there were tax collectors, there were the sinners, but also the Pharisees. They were complaining that Jesus not only associated with sinners, but ate with them. So, the younger son, he wants a new life, a better life, one away from the rules and authority of his father. He makes a bold play and asks for his inheritance. Most of you will have heard before from someone or other that in doing this, he was basically saying to his father, "I can't wait for you to die. I wish you were dead already because I want it now." An act of rebellion against his father, against the whole family. An act of rejection so huge in its context, I'm not sure there's really any better modern-day equivalent to describe it. He wants to break up the family farm, liquidate his share in a fire sale, leave his father and older brother with substantially reduced resources so he can travel and have fun. In one fell swoop, destroying what may have taken generations to build up. I think you'd be hard-pushed to think of a more selfish act. You know what happens. He is prodigal with his cash, and soon it is gone. He's feeding pigs, which are unclean animals for Jews, for a foreigner far from home. He comes to himself, or comes to his senses. He's hit rock bottom and remembers the food that even the servants of his father get every day. He's hungry and dirty, and he wants to come home. He cooks up a plan. Maybe because he's realized the depth of the betrayal and how broken his relationship with his father is. Or perhaps he's just really hungry. Either way, he sets out for home with his apology prepared and a plan. His plan is that if he grovels enough and works hard enough, he might gain some tiny speck of restitution. He's hopeful that he might be fed and at best have a servant-master relationship with his father. And this is where Jesus blows the minds of the Pharisees for the first time. He creates this word picture of a Middle Eastern patriarch, a man of wealth and standing in the community, who's been humiliated by his younger son. The text says, "So he returned home, and while he was still a long distance away, his father saw him coming." Or, "But while he was still at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him." In the Middle East, a man like this would not run. Kids run, maybe women, but this dignified, wealthy, grey-haired man picks up his robes, bares his legs like a child would, and races towards his son. The son doesn't even get to finish his prepared apology and lay out his plan to try to make some small repayment before the father has called for the ring, the robe, the shoes. You see, servants went barefoot, but sons wear shoes. And in so doing, the father has declared reconciliation in front of the rest of the family and also in front of the rest of the village. This is one of the clearest pictures of how much God is not only willing to forgive, but eager to forgive. Not grudgingly, after a big show of "this is how sorry I am," but even before we finish saying sorry. We, the lost sons, are so unworthy. We can never repay the debt, but we have a prodigal God, a God who is extravagant with his love and grace, pouring it out over and over, restoring us to sonship. We could never deserve it. I think one of the most moving things I've ever heard someone say about this part of the story was when my friend Joe Poynton, who's cringing in her seat, worried about what I'm about to say, she commented that it was while he was still a long way off that the father started running towards the son. You might be a long way off from God this morning. You might have turned your back on him deliberately. You might have actively put distance between the two of you. And this morning, if this is you, you can just turn towards home and he is already running, racing to meet you, waiting to feed you, clothe you, and claim you as his child once more. And this is only act one of the story. The older brother, act two. Did you know that in the Bible I read most often, the children's Bible with pictures, the story of the lost son doesn't even mention the older brother. It just stops with the younger son getting home. But the deeper that I've dug into this story, the more I think it's actually just as much or even more so about what happens next than about what has gone before. This older brother, as you've heard from Ben, he hears that his younger brother has returned and been welcomed and reconciled and restored to sonship by the father. And he is furious. It's his turn to reject his father, to rebel and humiliate him. He refuses to go inside to the feast, choosing to stay outside in the dark. He forces his father to come outside and find him and plead with him. He embarrasses him in front of all of his friends, addresses him rudely. Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and have never disobeyed you. He begins to add up the monetary cost of the celebration, the unfairness of the whole situation. And in doing so, he reveals his own rebellion, the bitterness in his heart, his self-righteous pride, his own mistaken view of what it is to be a son, his own warped view of who his father really is. And here it is. This is my epiphany, the bit that I've been getting wrong all these years. There are two lost sons. One is actively, openly in rebellion of the father, choosing his own path, defiantly eating the fruit. But the other is just as lost, out in the dark, refusing to accept the grace of his father, either towards his brother or for himself, instead choosing his own path of self-salvation, a life of measuring, recording, weighing, performing, judging, striving, slaving, not a son. He doesn't understand his father's love for him. He doesn't believe that his father simply delights in him. He's trying to control his father by following the rules. Jesus was speaking directly to the Pharisees. Yes, I eat with sinners. I love them. I will leave 99 sheep in open ground to search for the lost one. I will turn the house upside down, looking in all the darkest places for the lost. But don't kid yourselves. You are lost too. You are in the dark, rejecting your father who is pleading with you to come and join the feast. Jesus is redefining sin for the Pharisees. They believed they could attain righteousness by following the rules and being self-disciplined, by being good enough. Does this sound familiar to anyone? The older brother says, I've never disobeyed you, with his unspoken claim being, so you owe me. What does it feel like to be this older brother? Well, I think he was probably the kind of guy who felt a little bit happy when bad things happened to people around him. He might have been the kind of guy who struggled to celebrate other people's successes. I think when he heard about or saw other people's hardship, he might have sometimes patted himself on the back and thought, you know, if they were just a little bit more like me, they wouldn't be in that situation. I think he probably judged others harshly, felt good when people got what they deserved, and voted ACT. I'm just kidding about that last bit. But I do feel like I understand this older brother because sometimes I think I have a bit of that spirit of the older brother in me. Like Wilson preached about a few weeks ago, I often have the orthodoxy, the right beliefs, the orthopraxy, the right actions, but lack the right heart, that orthopathos. So, two lost sons. One lost because he'd been very bad, and the other just as lost because he's been so very good. Both are lost. Both are loved by the Father. The story ends here. It's a cliffhanger. We aren't told whether the older brother accepts his father's offer and the gift of grace. The Pharisees are reeling again. My sister-in-law, who's not a Christian, told me a story a few years ago that she had heard about a family who just had a new baby. The older sibling, who was about 4 or 5 years of age, asked the mum if he could go in and say goodnight to his new baby sister. The mother agreed and then listened very carefully to the baby monitor to hear what was happening in the baby's room. She heard her son whisper to the newborn, "Can you remind me what God looks like? I'm starting to forget." I wonder if some of us start to develop this attitude of the older brother because we've forgotten what our father really looks like. We start to base our self-image on being good and right. We find it easy to judge others and hard to forgive. When we fall and fail, we judge ourselves on how badly we feel about it and how hard we work trying to be better. We're trying to save ourselves. The process of becoming a Christian is realizing that we are lost, that we are unworthy, that we can never be good enough. There must be full atonement, however. Someone has to pay. Our Father, this prodigal God, has paid in full on the cross. His grace to us is that we get to come home and join the feast. Whether you're in the pig pen or in the dark outside the celebration, he comes and pleads with us, with each of us, to accept this grace. What Jesus did on the cross is a mystery that I can't honestly say I fully understand. But I get a glimpse of it when I see this father in this parable and his love for his two lost sons. What's the difference between the first two parables in this trio and the story of the lost son? In the lost sheep, the shepherd leaves the 99 sheep in open country and starts what Phil called the other week a rescue mission. In the lost coin, the woman searches her whole house carefully until she finds the lost coin. Where is the search for the lost son? Who goes on the rescue mission? Jesus is standing before the Pharisees as the missing character in the story. He is saying, "I am the one who searches high and low. I set out searching for you, to bring you home to your father. I came to rescue and find the son in the pig pen. I came to rescue and find the son who didn't even realize he was lost. I have come for you." I wonder if when we truly realize our lostness and that there is only one way home to our father, that we find the antidote to this older brother spirit of pride and self-salvation. I think it is in accepting how lost we are and accepting the gift of grace that we cannot earn, no matter how hard we try, no matter how good we are, that we are able to enter into the celebration feast. That's when we get the joy of our salvation. And out of this joy comes a desire to tell others about this gift, this grace, this freedom, the love of a prodigal God. We get a taste of the rejoicing of the shepherd, the celebration of the woman who finds her precious coin, the absolute joy of a father whose son that he thought was dead is alive again. Whether you're the son in the pig pen or the prideful older brother outside the feast in the cold, the message is the same. I have come to find you, to bring you home to your father. We're about to celebrate communion together. And I think it's a chance for all of us to take a moment to think about where we stand in the story. Which character do you most easily identify with? Like me, is it the older brother? Maybe you're a younger son. Maybe you're far from home, hungry, lonely. As we eat and drink and remember together the price that our God has paid for us to come home and join the feast, I pray that together as a church family, we rediscover the joy of our salvation and that it is out of this that we share our faith. Not because we should or because it's expected of us or is the right thing to do, but because we were lost and now we're found. Could I have maybe a couple of people from each section to come and help distribute the communion bits and pieces? And Dave and the band are going to be playing Create in Me a Clean Heart. So feel free just to sit and have a quiet moment. And when you have finished communion, feel free to stand and join in the song.